Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission. Here with episode 163 of Wheat All About It, or what I'm calling the episode about the biggest threat to Pacific Northwest production agriculture. My recording of a panel discussion on herbicide resistance that took place during the 2019 Tri-State Grain Growers Convention held at the Spokane Grand Hotel November 13th to 16th, 2019. There are a lot of threats to wheat farming, of course, but it was panelist and Craigmont, Idaho farmer Steve Riggers who said herbicide weed resistance may be production agriculture's biggest threat of all. Riggers' comments will be heard in episode 164, the second half of the panel discussion. Longtime listeners know this is not the first time I have produced an episode about herbicide weed resistance, also known as chemical weed resistance. For those wanting to investigate the topic further, you can go back to episodes 131 and 132 entitled, respectively, If Glyphosate's Glory Days Are Gone, What Comes Next? And The Wicked Problem of Herbicide Weed Resistance. There's also episode 46 entitled, The Challenge That Will Not Wait. Find these and other archived episodes at the Washington Grain Commission website, wagrains.org. Go to the bottom of the page, click on Summaries, and navigate back into time. I have worked on multiple efforts to educate farmers and the public about the seriousness of herbicide resistance beginning about 5 years ago. Since then, I've found there's always more to know about a biological function that reminds me of a line from the first Jurassic Park movie about all those female dinosaurs outwitting the scientists. Life will find a way. In the case of weeds, life makes billions of identical weeds of a particular species. But there's always a few mutants. Weeds that are just a hair off, genetically speaking, which makes them immune to the particular herbicide that kills all their mates. Over a relatively short period of time, what were just a few non-susceptible weed types become the majority of the population. I begin the first of this two-episode series with Ian Burke, a weed scientist at Washington State University, followed by Drew Lyon, a WSU Extension weed scientist. Both men hold endowed chairs funded by farmer dollars and created by the Washington Grain Commission. Burke was recently awarded the R.J. Cook Endowed Chair in Wheat Research, and Lyon holds the Small Grains Extension and Research Weed Sciences Chair. You'll hear speakers refer to their PowerPoint slides, and I have posted many of them on the Washington Grain Commission Facebook page. Although it's best to subscribe to the Wheat All About It podcast through various apps, including iTunes, Stitcher, Pocket Cast, Overcast, among others, following the WGC on Facebook will also do the trick as I post each episode there. There's no shortage of dire language around the myriad challenges farmers face. Ian Burke added to the supply, telling the crowded room of farmers, chemical reps, scientists, and others that the failure of herbicide systems is one of the most critical problems facing Pacific Northwest farmers.
I hope we can keep you engaged as possible this morning on what I think is probably, in my opinion, as a weed scientist, one of the most critical problems we're facing in the region. And that's the failure of our herbicide systems. And we have a lot riding on this. We have 40 years of efforts to improve conservation agriculture built on these herbicides. And to have them fail just at the cusp of a strong discussion on soil health and soil stewardship is, in my opinion, heartbreak. So this is a picture of a trail of kochia running across a field that's clearly a fallow field that's been treated with glyphosate in Walla Walla. This is close to home. And the interesting thing about this picture is it really encapsulates the social aspect of herbicide resistance. We had one grower select for the resistance, and then everyone else has to deal with it. it's a fundamentally a community issue. And so just to kind of give you a sense for where we are and where we're going, we have a lot on the line. So this is not an old picture. This is a relatively recent picture that shows a dust storm that is 2009. And that's a massive amount of erosion occurring. It's important here to remember that it's not the high rainfall zone that's going to have the biggest issues first. It's the growers who are on the very edge, who have large operations and narrow margins, that are going to suffer when they have to add an additional input to manage these weeds, or several different inputs to manage these weeds. That puts them over the top of being able to afford to grow wheat. And so the first decision that usually they make is, can I afford that another herbicide, or do I need to go backwards? And that's the direction we definitely don't want them to do. Do we go backwards and start doing tillage again? Some unique aspects from a global perspective about wheat. When you look at U.S. wheat, it's a pretty big number of acres planted, but the reality is we're a series of minor markets. So a very large percentage of the acreage in the central Great Plains doesn't get treated with a herbicide. Like less than 25% of Texas wheat actually gets treated. Sometimes it doesn't even get harvested. The northern Great Plains are a spring wheat market. They have a completely different weed spectrum than we do here. They have a spring wheat also requires a little bit different formulations because of increased safener load requirements. Here in the PNW, we treat all of our wheat with a herbicide every year, but three-quarters of the acreage gets treated with two different herbicides, either 2,4-D or MCPA. So that's sort of the benchmark price for a herbicide, and those are inexpensive. And it's difficult to get into a marketplace that's that competitive in terms of price. And so you put that all together, and we have a unique set of weeds, and the reality is, I think from a global perspective, the agricultural industry is not targeting U.S. wheat as a primary market for herbicide development. It's Europe that's driving the market. And if a product fits here, it might make it, but it might not. And so we're fighting that front. On a second front, transgenic glyphosate-resistant crops fundamentally transformed the herbicide market. They were introduced back in 1996, and you can see there's two different lines there. There's one that indicates herbicide patents. That's the circles, and the squares are the cumulative AI introductions, and you can see that there's a clear inflection point after the introduction of transgenic crops. There was a reduction in the number of active ingredients introduced, and the number of herbicide patents essentially went to zero. It takes 7 to 10 years to get a new herbicide after it's patented. So we're living through a trough of herbicide discovery that we're likely not going to ever recover from. And then you put that all together with, which is unfortunate, we've got a slide here that didn't function right, but it's a list of all the herbicides that would, by discovery date. It starts back in 1971 with glyphosate, and you can see over a period of time that curve is slowly flattening out. We're running out of new herbicides. Now, I'm not saying we're going to not get any more new herbicides. I think we're going to continue to get new ones. We're not going to get anything like as transformative as glyphosate. Many of my colleagues have compared the invention of glyphosate to penicillin. We're just not going to get something as effective, broadly effective, as safe, and as durable as glyphosate has been. So when you really drill down to a weed species like something like downy brome, this is what we're faced with. So this is a list of all the herbicides that we would commonly use to control this weed. You can see the year of registration on the right and the year we discovered herbicide resistance on the left. We have resistance to all the post-emergence herbicides we would use. Many of our downy brome populations have resistance in the same field to multiple modes of action. It's only a matter of time before we're not going to be able to control the downy brome after it emerges in the field. On a widespread basis. So what we're here to do today is just talk through maybe a different approach before it's too late, because I think we need a concerted effort to address this issue beyond what we're doing, the piecemeal effort on the part of the three states to fund weed science programs that are also trying to leverage funding from industry and also from the USDA isn't working. We need a coordinated effort to really push this over the top into something that maybe looks like a sustainable system, because we're headed to a place where it's not. So to do that and to start that discussion, we've got a really great panel here. So we've got, to begin with, Drew is going to give you an overview of herbicide resistance, and then Katie's going to give us a sense for social aspects of herbicide resistance. Steve's going to give a personal perspective as a grower, and then Doug's going to talk us through maybe what a vision would look like that would be useful for us to maybe potentially think about engaging in funding. So, Drew?
All right. I think the purpose I have in my little presentation is just to kind of introduce you to how herbicide resistance happens. Maybe give you a little talk about some of the things we can attempt to do in a very general sense. So I always start this talk about herbicide resistance with this gentleman. How many people remember Charles Darwin from their freshman biology class in high school or college? Okay, so Charles Darwin wrote a book that all of us should be familiar with. Anybody remember the name of that book? On the Origin of Species. That would be a great title if you're trying to sell it in the marketplace, but scientists don't write titles that short. The actual title is On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection or the Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. Now that sounds like a scientist's title to me. The key here, we a lot of people get stuck on this part, but this is really the big scientific discovery and the one that really has no, in the scientific community, there's no opposition to this. This is as strong a scientific theory as there is out there, and that's natural selection. So that's the process of how evolution occurs. We can get in some arguments about this, but nobody's going to argue, at least in the scientific community, about natural selection. You can see it happen in a petri dish in the lab within a few days with fruit flies. And basically, for natural selection to occur, three things have to exist. You have to have a struggle for existence. If life is easy peasy and everybody gets to leave the same number of offspring, there is no natural selection. But in general, life is a struggle. There has to be variation in the population. Not every individual can be the same. If every individual is the same, there's no natural selection. And then that variation has to be inheritable. You need to be able to pass that variation on to your offspring. So if you have all three of these things, natural selection can occur. Here's a picture of natural selection, or I guess you could call it artificial selection because man is putting it on there, but the principle is the same. This is a field up near Reardon, put out some herbicide plots. This is some barley. This is mayweed chamomile, also known as dog fennel. I've sprayed a group 2 herbicide on this, and what do you see happening there? There's some dead plants here. There's some not-so-healthy plants there, and there's some nice green ones there. Next year, when I come out to that field and look at the weeds, are they going to look more like these guys, this guy, or this one? This one, right? This is going to produce a lot more seed, and next year's generation is going to look a lot more like that than it is like any of these others. And that's basically what we're doing. We're slowly, by applying the same selection pressure year after year, we're going to favor these individuals that have the gene for resistance. These are going to die out, and over time, the population's all going to have the resistance gene. So, I can't stop there. I got to go a little longer because that's too quick a presentation. But these are some slides from the WSSA that kind of shows how this happens. This is actually, example is actually taken from the Pacific Northwest because this is what happened in Russian thistle and prickly lettuce with Glean. How many people remember Glean herbicide, that wonderful herbicide that took care of every weed problem you had until it didn't? What happens is there's if you have a mutant in a population, we have mutants all the time. Our genes don't replicate perfectly every time. You get a mutant. If a mutation's negative, it dies out. If it's positive, it builds up. If it's really conferring no positive or negative. It tends to exist in a population at a very low frequency. In this case, it's thought that the gene for resistance to glean existed in about 1 in a million plants had it. That mutant was out there at a low frequency. So about 1 in a million, 0.0001% of the population had it, represented by the red plant. You have the plants, you have the seed bank. You've not made any application at all. So the herbicide's not causing the mutation, right? It's just naturally occurring out there beforehand. You make your first application, and you kill off a lot of the susceptibles, leave some of the resistance. They start producing seed. You get 99.99% control, and you think you have yourself a great herbicide that you are definitely going to use again. So in the case of glean, they used it in the wheat and in the fallow. It had a long soil residual, so it was exerting that pressure on the population for a continued period of time. You go out and you apply it a second time. Now you have a few more resistant plants out there, but now it's 0.02%, so you're getting 99.98% control, and most growers I know are pretty happy with 99.98% control. You're starting to fill the seed bank up, depleted of the susceptibles, starting to make it a higher ratio of resistance, a few more, but you still are getting good control. You go out and apply it a third time. Now 0.294% of your population is resistant, so you're still getting 99.9 or 99.8% control. So you're still very happy with it, and you don't think there's any problem at all. And you keep going along, and you apply it a fourth time. Now 4% of your population is resistant. That's still 96% control. You notice, well, didn't work quite so well this year, but maybe it was the environment. Maybe I didn't get it put out just right. But you're still going to put it out, and in that fifth year you put it out, and lo and behold, 60% of your population is now resistant. So you go from not having much of a problem to having a big problem really quickly. You've been building it all along. You just didn't realize you were building it all along. So by the fifth year, and this is exactly what happened with glean, 5 years after its introduction, we had about half our Russian thistle population in the Pacific Northwest was resistant to glean. Okay? You've now filled up the seed bank with resistant seed. If there's no fitness penalty for that, that is if these plants, resistant plants, produce just as much seed as susceptible plants, you're never going back. That population's always going to be there, or at least in your lifetime. So how does this happen? The length of time it takes, it depends on the cultural practices you use. How frequently do you use herbicides, and particularly herbicides of similar mechanism of action? What mechanism of action you use? ACCAs and the ALS inhibitors, group 1 and 2, tend to select pretty quickly because it tends to be just a one gene change and you get resistance. It's also dependent on the biology of the weed. Weeds that are very genetically diverse tend to have those genes out there, and you tend to select for them. Something like Russian thistle, very diverse, you tend to select more quickly than if the biotypes aren't quite so variable. And the frequency of the resistant biotype, is it 1 in a million plants out there, 1 in 10 million? Maybe it doesn't exist at all. But all those factors come together to influence how many years it takes. Glyphosate took a long time. It was introduced in 71, and we really didn't start seeing resistance until quite a bit later. Glean, we saw it within 5 years. So all these things come together. Here's kind of a graph, number of species representing herbicide-resistant biotypes starting in 1955 and the different classes of herbicides here. We started in 1955. The first synthetic organic herbicide was 2,4-D. It was developed as part of the World War II effort, became commercialized shortly after World War II, and that was some of our first resistance issues in the early 50s. So within about 10 years of 2,4-D coming out, we already had wild carrot, and I forget what the other species are, but we had selected for resistant biotypes already. So as long as synthetic herbicides have been, organic herbicides have been out there, we've been selecting for resistance. Where this is the one that should get a lot of wheat growers very scared. This is group 2 ALS inhibitors. What group do we use most in wheat production? Group 2. And you can see it's almost a straight line up here. A lot of resistance here. This is the one that's getting all the headlines, group 9. That's our glyphosate. So introduced back in the early 70s. We didn't really get resistant biotypes until the mid-90s, about the time we started treating lots of acres with glyphosate because we now had resistant crops to it. That's taking off, but we've had herbicide resistance for a very long time. So how do we deal with it? Use the general principles of integrated weed management. Prevent weed problems before they start. So try not to develop weed issues. Grow a competitive crop. I always tell people this is your best herbicide, a good competitive crop. I've put out a lot of herbicide trials in my career, and a herbicide always looks better in a competitive crop than it does in a non-competitive crop. They rely on that competition to help you out. And then use practices that keep weeds off balance. So human nature is when you find something that's working for you, you stick with it until it doesn't. The more you do the same thing over and over again, the quicker you're going to select for resistance. That's not just herbicide resistance. The more you do the same tillage year after year, you're going to select for those biotypes or those species that do well in that tillage system. The more you do anything over and over again, you select for things that will do well in that system. Here's a risk of resistance per species. So this is whether you're at low, moderate, or high risk for developing resistance, and these are some management options. So herbicide mix or rotation in cropping systems, use more than two modes of action, you're at low risk. You use one mode of action, you just use the ALS inhibitors, you're at high risk. Weed control, do you use cultural, mechanical, and chemical control, or do you rely just on chemicals? The more things you can bring to bear, the better. Here's one that the Australians have really hit upon, and it took me a second to figure out why this is, but if you have low weed populations, you're at low risk. If you have high weed infestation, you're high risk. Why would that be? Yes. It's a numbers game, right? If you got a million plants out there, you got one plant that might have that gene. If you have 20 million plants out there, you probably got 20 plants out there that might have it. So one of the real things the Australians are trying to do is keep those weed infestations low. The worst thing you can do is go out to your weediest field and put that brand new mechanism of action out there that's never been used, and you put a strong selection pressure on that, and pretty soon you're going to develop resistance. But that's what we tend to do, right? I got a weed problem. What's the latest new technology I can throw out there to control it? And I'm going to put it on the worst field I have. You've just really kick-started the process for selecting biotypes that are resistant.
Before ending this episode, I'm returning to Burke, who closed out an otherwise gloomy meeting with an optimistic outlook about agriculture having solved intractable problems before. Think about the massive erosion of the past. There was a program that helped change that.
Historically, we had something that worked on what we thought was a really complicated problem. And it was called the STEEP program. It functionally reduced erosion across the region from 30 tons the acre to 5 tons that we currently sit at. So there's a model for solving complicated problems. It involved economists, it involved rural sociologists, it involved a whole host of different agricultural sciences coming together and working together for a common good and common solution. So we know we can do it. We know we can solve complicated problems. It's just finding the willpower to get behind this particular problem.
Recognizing the problem and fixing it, of course, are two different things. But I've got to hand it to Burke and Lyon. They haven't been wallflowers when it comes to letting farmers and chemical companies know where they're coming from. In fact, from my point of view, the pair are doing the university equivalent of shouting from the rooftops. I hope it's having an effect. If so, perhaps we'll look back to the year 2020 as a turning point. Next week in episode 164, the panel discussion continues as University of Idaho rural sociologist Katie Densman and UI's North Idaho Extension educator Doug Finkelberg discuss how working together can help solve the problem, while Craigmont, Idaho farmer Steve Riggers recalls how we have gotten between this rock and a hard place. Be sure to join me for episode 164, the second part of the episode about the biggest threat to Pacific Northwest production agriculture. right here on Weed All About It.
Don't like chemicals, don't like killing. Look in your kitchen, the story there's chilling. Plant food, Windex, mouse bait too. Mr. Clean, easy off, even pet shampoo. You wanna be a hypocrite? Just forget to have the shit. We feed you.